Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Chamber Music Tulsa, in the course of presenting the Ariel Quartet this weekend, will also be presenting one of the true giants in the world of chamber music and classical music, as pianist Menachem Pressler will be a guest artist with the Ariel in Dvorak's Piano Quintet in A on Sunday. Pressler, who will turn 90 years old in December, is a founding member of one of the finest chamber music groups ever, the Beaux-Arts Trio. For 53 seasons, through a number of personnel changes and recordings that span the entire repertoire of the piano trio, Pressler was a part of this seminal chamber group until he disbanded it in 2008. But Pressler continues to be an incredibly active musician, performing with orchestras around the world as a soloist, playing solo engagements and chamber music with top chamber groups. He's also continues to be a full-time teacher at the Indiana University School of Music, where he's taught for over 50 years, and has a seemingly inexhaustible supply of energy and passion for music making. And he joins us today as our guest on Studio Tulsa. He'll be performing with the Ariel Quartet in Dvorak's Piano Quintet Sunday afternoon at the Tulsa PAC. And Menachem Pressler joins us today from Bloomington, Indiana. Menachem Pressler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be talking to you, and certainly a pleasure to come to Tulsa.
You'll be performing with the Ariel Quartet this Sunday. How did the connection between you and the quartet come about?
Actually, it came through our manager. We both have the same manager. Although the quartet actually comes from Israel, where I come from, too. And, of course, they came via Russia to Israel, and I came via Germany to Israel. But we met in America, and we had some concerts, and we enjoyed each other, and we're looking forward to the concert now.
Can you talk about, you know, you've had such a long association with Beaux-Arts, and, of course, you've also had a long association with the Emerson Quartet as well, doing piano work with them when you do piano quintets. But what are the things you try to feel out about other chamber musicians when you start performing with them? What do you look for?
You see, with the Emersons, I started working 35 years ago. They studied with me in a way because they played every piece for piano for the first time with me. We met in Vermont. We had 3 weeks every summer. We met also on tour at different places. So the Emersons I'm very close to for many reasons, personal reasons, having worked with them. And now I do the same thing with the Pacifica Quartet. And actually, I was just now in Texas, where it's a wonderful quartet called the Miro, which I played with. Now, what do I look for? I look for that which I found in the Beaux-Arts by hard work. It was the illumination of what is music. That means we don't play only what is in the notes, but we play what's between the lines. We try to find what is the message of the composer. And that, of course, is a big task. And to find that, you have to play and you have to try again and you have to try again, because obviously, it takes nearly a lifetime to get to the bottom of a Schubert trio or the bottom of an Archduke trio or the bottom of these Brahms B major trio. These are great, great works which demand all your technical expertise, all your musicianship, all your experience in playing ensemble. But in addition to that, there is that mountain to climb, which is called, in other words, inspiration. It's not just inspiration, I call it actually love, because it's that which drove you to become a musician. It is that which drives you, and especially me at my age, to run through the world, to do that which I love the most, perform. Perform those works that I love, that I know, and that I try with every sense that I have to go deeper and deeper. You know, there is a biography that came out in England, written about me, and the title of the biography is "There's Always More to Be Found," And that is one of the things that I do believe in. The proof is the trio did that year after year. I do that in my teaching. I do that in my own solo playing. It is always the search for deeper identification with those great works. And you know that the soul that you have is also, it's like a flower. You have so many layers that when you take, until you get to one layer, which is the layer, and you are able to infuse your music with that. That's what I'm looking for.
Earlier you talked about the mountain as a metaphor, and certainly through your experience and such a long career, you're pretty high up on the mountaintop. But there must be something special about a young group such as the Ariel Quartet, very accomplished musicians, but there's probably two generations between the two of you. Is there something
more than that?
Yeah, maybe that. Three, yes. Is there something special about that youthfulness that you, with the experience, long for, I guess? Maybe that's the best way to put it.
That's not a good way, because I don't look for the usefulness that they supply. The usefulness I have in me. When I play, I am young. Yes, you are laughing, but that's the truth. You know, I was asked by the big German magazine called Der Spiegel, which means the mirror, which is like Time magazine in America. The man said, "Mr. Pressler, how does a pianist at a biblical age feel?" Oh, I was stunned when he asked me that question. And I told him, what is the truth? I said, when I perform, I'm never older than 50. When I teach, I'm not older than 40. But when I go up the stairs, I feel my age. So when I play with a young quartet, it's not for their usefulness. Yes, I love the enthusiasm, because I have that enthusiasm, and I love to meet that enthusiasm. But I also love the eagerness in which they will come to a performance, not to a performance, because what is even more important is the rehearsal before the performance, so that we are coming to some kind of meeting of the minds, or meeting of the hearts, or meeting of the souls, that we can perform a work where we are united in the way of getting to the heart of the work. And that's what I find in the Ariel. And I am on my way to go right from Tulsa. I'm going to San Francisco, where I play with the faculty and with students, where I look for the same. And I just, as I told you, I played with the Pacifica in last week. I was in Portland, Oregon. I played two concerts with the quartet, and I played two works in Texas. So I am continuously on the search for the bluebird of happiness. And I like them to see it too.
You're going to be performing the Dvorak Quintet in A, a wonderful work. And I'm sure you've coached this as well as performed it on many occasions.
I actually have a beautiful recording with the Emerson.
We're going to hear that in just a moment, as a matter of fact. What's your most important piece of advice when you're coaching this particular piece? What are the things you think are foremost in keeping in mind in this particular work?
And first of all, the beauty of the writing. The writing is exquisite. It's one of the quintets which has, how shall I say, which has something beautiful for each instrument. Each instrument is being blessed in this quartet. And, you know, in my I have a birthday program on the 7th of November in Paris at the Playel, where I play with the Eben Quartet. And I will play the Dvorak Quintet, because it has been very close to my heart, has been close to my soul. So what do I look for? It's the beauty that is expressed, and that the dance is being felt together, that in a Dumka we can be sad and at the same time also be happy. And look for the sense of brightness, of brilliance that happens in the writing, which is not virtuosity for virtuosity's sake. No, it is brilliant for the light that brilliance shines, and that is so beautiful in that quintet. I mean, the scherzo, certainly influenced by Mendelssohn, but seen through Czech eyes. And those eyes were just so beautiful that Brahms even liked those eyes. Although he did say to him, "Can't you write orthographically correct music?" So you see that even Dvořák has his weakness.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the scherzo, because we actually have your performance with the Emerson Quartet of that scherzo. Let's hear a little bit. This is by my guest today, pianist Menachem Pressler, who is a co-founder of the Beaux-Art Trio and will be performing with the Ariel Quartet this Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. That's music from the Dvořák Quintet in A, which will be performed by my guest, pianist Menachem Pressler, with the Ariel Quartet. That's his recording with the Emerson Quartet, who he's had a long association with as well. The Ariel Quartet will be Chamber Music Tulsa's next guest this Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center, and my guest, Menachem Pressler. Well, of course, we all know you for the Beaux-Art Trio, and it's now been 5 seasons since the last performance of the Beaux-Art Trio. Do you miss it?
Yeah, of course, of course. Would you not miss your first wife?
Of course.
Where you spent a whole lifetime with, where everything that you did was infused and influenced by it. What is only strange is I stopped the Beaux-Arts because my violinist, Daniel Hope, who's a magnificent violinist, and he started a solo career. And I felt, no, I don't want to bring up another violinist. I just think it's time to stop while we are on top. What I didn't realize is that I started to play solo, and all of a sudden I am discovered. I'm playing in the biggest halls. I'm playing this season with the Berlin Philharmonic, with the Amsterdam Concertgebouw in their subscription series, with the Orchestra de Paris for the 3rd year in a row, where they make a film of 2 Mozart concerti with me. I didn't realize that. I thought I was, after I stopped the trio, and then I see one review of a Paris recital, the DVD came out, and the critic writes, it's a pity he didn't stop the trio earlier. I was just flabbergasted.
Well, that's kind of interesting because you were a soloist to begin with. You were, how that's the trio true. Came together was really happenstance. You'd made a bunch of concerto recordings, and you'd done some solo recordings, and you said, I want to do a trio album. That's how it came together.
Exactly, that's what I said to MGM, to the producer, and he said, get 2 people. No, I got 2 people, and then a trio fell out at a Beethoven performance at Tanglewood. Münch called up my violinist, who used to be concertmaster of Toscanini, and he said to him, can you jump in, play a Beethoven program? And we played a Beethoven program, a big Beethoven program with the trio Opus 1 number 3 in C minor, The Ghost and The Archduke. And after the concert, instead of having 9 concerts, play a record and then say goodbye to each other, we had 70 concerts. And it never stopped.
At what point did you and your colleagues, Daniel Guillet and Bernard Greenhouse, decide that the trio would be the focal point for your music making? Because as you mentioned, Guillet was a concertmaster in Toscanini's orchestra. Greenhouse was, I believe, the principal cellist at that time.
No, he was not. Greenhouse at that time played in a group called the Bach Aria Group. Ah. And he was a freelance musician. He had the most beautiful sound, so the Costellanis and everybody took him at a premium, and he made this money to have money to play his yearly recital. He was aiming for a solo career. Mm-hmm. Now, when we got 70 concerts after our first concert, and we played in all those little towns around the country, driving a car, we started to play, and we realized soon enough that there was something that bound us. There was something in which we felt music alike. There was something where it became, how shall I say, we were three, but it was bigger than three. The three of us created something that was called Bozart Trio, that was bigger than the three each of us was. So it was not just that three good musicians played together, like it is very much the case now. And no, it became something very special in our attitudes to playing. This is something which I cannot explain so easily, because for that to happen, that, yes, that happens in the Emerson Quartet, that happens in the Ebony Quartet, that happens hopefully in our quartet that we are seeing now in Tulsa. So that is something that you cannot describe. There is some element which unites the mind and the heart at a given moment. And that creates the great moment in music. That's why you go to a concert. You don't go to a concert to hear a nice, no, maybe you do, but a concert is supposed to be like a religious event. You go to a concert to be elevated. You go to a concert when you leave that you had an impression in your heart, in your soul, that something happened during that concert in one phrase or another that is unforgettable, that you will always remember, that you will love that work because of that great moment that you will hear. Now, a guarantee there doesn't exist. You have to find it each time. You can name it under the word inspiration. You can name it under any kind of word, whatever it is. But it is something very special. Because when, as a musician, you go to play, of course, it is your religion. You play the work. You go to a concert hall. It is your temple or your church. And you perform not to show them that you can play, not to show them that, yes, you know the Dvořák better than the ones who listen. No, to give them an experience that you can, in quotation mark, call unforgettable. That was the Bozart Trio's prime point. And it succeeded beyond my expectation, succeeded beyond Gillet's expectation, and Bernie Greenhouse, probably the most beautiful cellist that there was, although my last cellist, Antonio Meneses, was a great, great cellist, like Daniel Hope was a great violinist. Both are great. But there was something that was so special among the first three of us that created the Bozart Trio. Gillet was a terrible rehearsal. He threw out insults after insults. I didn't mind it. My cellist minded it. They were fighting. But I didn't mind it. I thought, my God, what do I learn? What do I find out about music? It's unheard of. And then when he left the trio and then died, I became the bad man. I became the one who demanded and who asked and who insisted. A rehearsal was a very, very important moment in our lives. And so when you ask what it is, that's what it is.
I'm struck by something you said earlier. You mentioned that you find that you're back in demand as a soloist. Was that something you had put on the back burner because of the commitment?
No, I didn't put it on the back. I did play solo, and I did it only because my cellist always said, Menachem, you have too much energy. Please do something else so that we can rest. Because we used to play 100 concerts a season. And I was teaching full-time at Indiana, which I still do at my age. I still teach full-time. But no, I did learn the works. But if you ask me if it was influenced, my solo playing, by that, what the trio achieved, yes, yes. But I didn't know that my sound right now would create that kind. I have now two new records being released. And that's pretty unheard of at 92 or 89 to make two new records. that the companies will want to have records from you. So what it is, I don't know. What my attitude is, yes, I told you. It is the search for that which makes this music eternal, which makes that which gives my life a reason. I'm playing not the concert to have another date or to get paid. No, that is not the point right now. For me, it is a fulfillment. It is reaching something that all my life I have been striving for, having been wanting to do. It was to perform music. I was hungry, and I am at my age still hungry.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to use this as a summing up question, but it makes sense at this particular point. You know, in professional athletics or dance, there are two types of elite artists and athletes towards the end of their careers. Those who don't want to be seen in decline, and those who play for the love of the game, if you will, who play as long as they can. I think that comparison to music suffers a little bit because you can always enjoy music always. But is there criteria for you for performing professionally? I would think there would be high standards.
Of course. If it is not the highest standard, I will stop it. I will be the first to hear it, and I will stop it. No. There is no excuse for age because we do exchange something that the athletes don't have. The athletes have only the athletics. We in music have not only the athletics. We don't have to be the quarterback. We don't have to be the defensive back. No, we simply take a work that needs more depth, that needs more sense of beauty, and we perform it. Now, you don't have many people. You had a Horshovsky who got to the stage, who played and played beautiful. The older he got, he became more beautiful in his playing, and he was nearly blind. Now, I'm a different kind of type. I don't even have glasses, and my doctor tells me God has forgotten you. So I don't even wear glasses. So it's not the decline that I would excuse and do. No, I would not excuse it. If I would not perform, and I have performed in Vienna, I jumped in for Uchida, and I performed for 2,000 people a Schubert evening, two big sonatas, and a piece by Kurtak, who is a contemporary composer, very, very magnificent, who wrote it for me. If they hadn't said on the next day in the newspaper, we haven't heard since Wilhelm Kempf a concert like this, it astounded me when I read it. Because I didn't expect any of that. I did what I do. I played with my understanding, with all my heart, with all my soul. But that it would have effect like that, I did not know. And therefore, when the Berlin Philharmonic said it would be an honor to have you, the Concertgebouw, which is one of the finest orchestras in the world, had me change my date, the birthday concert in New York, to fly to Amsterdam on my birthday and to play with them five concerts. No, I did not know that. And I did not do that when they didn't hire me to be an athlete who is going down. No. No, then they would not hire me. They would all honor me and they would greet me, but they would not engage me. No, they wouldn't. I'm playing with great conductors, and they have no excuses for me or for anyone else playing that music. What they look for, too, is that what I look for. Depth, beauty, etc.
I heard your performances with Paavo Järvi last season, and the playing was beautiful, and you were doing Mozart, and there was just such a wonderful chamber approach to it. Even though it is a solo concerto, and you know you had your moments, the playing within was just so beautifully contoured in almost a chamber setting. It was very, very beautiful playing, I must say.
Thank you so much. You know what he said to me after the rehearsal? He says, Menachem, you made me young again and love music all over again. That's what he told me after the rehearsal.
That's great.
That is great. That is worth playing for.
Now, I want to say early happy 90th birthday. That'll take place in December. I read an interview where you said, you know, there are certain things I shouldn't do anymore, even though you may want to, and that be to play a Brahms concerto or, you know, something with more power. But I think you are playing a lot of Mozart these days. And
I played just last 10 days ago. I played in the town where I was born, Magdeburg. I played Beethoven 4th,
yes,
which is a fantastic piece. So, yes, you're right. I will not play now Brahms. I always wanted to. No, I wouldn't. I will not play Liszt. I always did that. I will not play Rachmaninoff. I always play that. No, that is not anymore for me, because the athletics in those concerts is not what I am after now. I'm after something else. I may play Schumann. I may play Beethoven 4. I will play Mozart. I will play Beethoven 1st, Beethoven 2nd, Beethoven 3rd. All the Beethovens. Yes, I may do that. I had that always in my repertoire. But I will play only that which I feel I contribute something which only I can contribute to the vista of that music. That's what I do. That's why Paavo said those things to me. Because even I played with the youngster in Montreal at the Mozart Fest. I played with Kit Armstrong, the Mozart concerto for two pianos, Kent Nagano conducting, a magnificent conductor. And he immediately heard that it was not the usual, and he changed his approach. It was really a pleasure to do that. And I played in Verbier, I played a sonata evening with Maxim Vengerov. And that was special. This summer I'm going to play with Josh Bell, also one of the superstars, and used to be my student. So, no, I will do what I can and where I can contribute something which, to a certain extent, only I can do.
Well, we'll look forward to your contributions in the Dvorak this Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Menachem Pressler, it's been a great honor to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for calling, and I'm looking very, very much forward to play in Tulsa and with a lovely young quartet. All my best.
The distinguished professor of music from Indiana University, the co-founder of the Beaux-Arts Trio, and a chamber music legend, Menachem Pressler, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be a guest with the Ariel Quartet and the Dvorak Quintet in A this Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center as a part of Chamber Music Tulsa's series. For more information on his appearance, visit chambermusictulsa.org. Well, we're going to leave you with a little more music by Menachem Pressler with his beloved Beaux-Arts Trio. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.